Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
And I'm Kathleen McGowan.
And today we are going to focus on you, Kathleen McGowan.
Oh my.
It's you, I know, because it's you who have out a new book, the third in the Magdalen Line series, After the Expected One, and the Book of Love, the newborn one, is called The Poet Prince.
I am so excited about this book. I mean, I think for all authors, the week of a major book release is a lot like having a child. It's a lot like giving birth. You've worked and labored to create, you know, this being that's coming into the world, and here it is. So it's always very exciting. And every book sort of carries its own energy and has its own life. And with every book, I say, oh, gosh, I'm so excited about this book. But this book is very special. And I'm going to let you talk about it a little bit, too, because I know that this book is very special for you for a lot of reasons. And I want you to talk about that because I think it's important. But there's so much in this book that has to do with art and with history and with spirit. And it's just the subject matter dealing with the Italian Renaissance, dealing with the birth of the greatest art in human history, dealing with these extraordinary characters like Lorenzo de' Medici and Sandro Botticelli, who are really the focal point of this particular book. And certainly the women who were their muses, because, of course, there's always an aspect of women's history in my book. Any of my books, but this book is a little bit of a departure for me because rather than focusing on the women, I really wanted to focus on the men. And that's why it's the Poet Prince, because the Poet Prince is the male counterpart to the Expected One.
Yes, I mean, first of all, there's so many things to start talking about. You quite often are considered to be a feminist writer, but me being a man, in your previous books, I've always felt that both sides were very much equally balanced, because you have that, you know, that female and that male aspect in your writing, but also in the material which you discuss. But yes, I mean, going back to the first thing as to the Poet Prince, when more than a year ago, you revealed on a different radio show that you were working on the Poet Prince, I kind of like felt, oh my God, somebody else is going to try yet again to tackle the Renaissance. And quite often what you get, read the Da Vinci Code, you get such an enormous redux of a very complex history subject. And everybody who tackles the Renaissance, whether it's in fiction or non-fiction, they begin to see that it's a swamp. And 95% of the people who enter it basically drown. And the other 4%, they get out, but again, by doing this redux, by doing something extremely complex and either focusing on an aspect of it or focusing on something which it really isn't, but kind of like, you know, which they can get away with. So I was, first of all, extremely impressed with the fact that you were daring to take it on. But then over the next year, I also saw that you actually pulled it off. So that is even more remarkable. And yes, I mean, as a novel, it's brilliant. It leaves you crying. I think, you know, I do not cry easily when it comes to fiction or movies. But specifically, for people who do, I can tell you that there will be passages in this book where you will start to cry pretty much early on. And by the time of the end of the book comes about, there will have been something there which definitely will leave you crying. Because these people are brought back to life. These are no longer one-dimensional characters, i.e. read Da Vinci. These are really the people who live and breathe, and you live with them as they go along in their lives. But at the same time, what you've been able to do is also focus on the complexity of the Renaissance. And I think, again, that is the biggest challenge, because the Renaissance is such a hard and a difficult and a complex subject, which we'll dig into in the next few minutes, that really it is. It's very difficult to pull it off, but again, the poet prince has pulled that off. So congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, Poet Prince. Say that three times fast. well, you know, the complexities of the Renaissance are what make it so difficult to write about, because there's so much going on, there's so much material to work with, that really sort of trying to narrow it down and hone in on the aspects of the story that you want to tell is what makes it the trickiest. I mean, books on the Renaissance could be and probably should be thousands of pages long because there is so much specifically to look at. I wanted to focus on aspects that had not been focused on. I wanted to look at these sort of heretical underpinnings that were happening through the Medici family, and certainly that found their way into the art, because no one had done that. And that was originally what I thought was my intention going into it. I say this all the time when I talk about writing. I always start a book thinking I know exactly what it's going to be. And then once I begin writing it, the characters really take over and change my mind. And it's completely out of my hands, which probably sounds a little bit crazy. But I think all all fiction writers are actually a little bit crazy, which is why we're fiction writers, because we do have to allow these characters to come to life. I know that if my characters are not controlling the story, then I am not in the groove I need to be in with fiction. If I feel that a story is plot-driven, something's wrong. And I always have to go back to the drawing board and say, this is all about the character. And it's not until I completely connect to the characters that I know that my book is really ready to go. And that's what happened here. And what happened was I went to Florence to begin doing this research on Lorenzo de' Medici. Let me back up for a minute and say, for those who are familiar with my work, my first novel was called The Expected One. And The Expected One comes from an ancient prophecy, which is then recorded again in the Middle Ages in Belgium and in French, specifically L'Attendu, the prophecy of the expected one. And the expected one is a prophecy about a woman or a series of women who will come forth and accomplish certain tasks. Now, the prophecy of the expected one contains astrological references. The expected one will always be born within a certain period of the vernal equinox, for example. So the prophecy says, here is who she is and here is what she will do. And that was the basis of the expected one, was that prophecy. And my key character, Maureen, is the expected one. And she fulfills this prophecy and achieves these things. So what happened in the process of writing that and then the sequel to the Book of Love is I realized that, women aren't the only people who have been dealt a very, very unfair hand by history. The catchphrase on all of my books is the truth against the world. And that's what I care to do. I care to dig into history and find the truth. And what I realized as I began to do this research is that a lot of men, a lot of truly great, beautiful, extraordinary men have also really gotten the shaft historically. And this, for me, is never more true than it was when I started investigating the Medici family. So I'm going to put that aside for a second because we're going to come back specifically to the accomplishments of the Medici and ultimately why they have been demonized by history when instead they should be celebrated. But I want to talk a little bit about what I discovered in this process is that there was a male prophecy. There is a prophecy about men coming forward in the same way that there is a prophecy about women coming forward. So the prophecy of the expected one for the women had a counterpart, or let's call it a twin soul prophecy, the prophecy of the poet prince. And the poet prince is the male who is going to come forward with also very specific astrological configurations and accomplish a series of tasks.
I don't know whether you want to continue on the male prophecy line or whether you want to shift to the Medicis, but they were the family who really began to create the world we now live in. When we look at the Renaissance, probably people think about Leonardo da Vinci, him again.
Ugh.
And I know, you love him so much.
I'm just tired of him getting credit for everything when he completed about 15 paintings in his entire life and doesn't deserve credit for it. He had the best PR people in history. I don't know who they were, but I could sure use them. Anyway, go on. I'm going to groan a lot every time Leonardo is mentioned until we actually get into talking about him. So.
Absolutely. And so that's the first thing people compare kind of the Renaissance with at this moment in time. Then you have the entire other line of like artists like Botticelli. Now you will probably want to smile and cheer.
And cheer and celebrate.
Because he's a very principal character in your book. And Botticelli is part of the Platonic Academy. And the Platonic Academy is really run by the Medici family. And already here's this very interesting historical fact, which is that Leonardo never got into it. He was on the outskirts, but he really never was part of that really Platonic Academy, which convened on the Medici's estate and kind of like, you know, learned not just to paint, but learned the entire aspects. And again, these are things which we'll come back to. Now, at that moment in time, most of the attention goes to Lorenzo de Medici, also the main character of your book. But he is a descendant, if you want, of a family, the Medici family, and really the first person who starts to come to prominence in that family is Cosimo de' Medici. He's the one who pushes out the big bucks. He becomes the first entrepreneur, the first person who really isn't noble, and in fact the Medicis to a large extent are the first family who start to buy noble titles. Who really is from a merchant background, and he becomes extremely rich. And with that money, he is starting to do good deeds. He sends people across the world searching for specific manuscripts. We will come back to that as well, of course. And he also begins to invest in artists who are beginning to paint in a very specific way. Rather than just paint whatever comes to mind, he wants to almost have them paint in the way the ancient Egyptians paint, with intent, with style, with knowledge, within a larger framework. And so we really are going to go back to, and the book goes back to the beginning of the 15th century with figures like Cosimo Ficino, who begin to really lay the foundation for the poet prince.
Well, Cosimo de' Medici is such an important character, and he, you know, there's a reason that the Florentines call him Patria Patriae, the father of our country, because he really was. In fact, Cosimo de' Medici in so many ways is the founder of sort of modern civilization as we know it. I mean, talk about the first Renaissance man. I mean, he literally is the first Renaissance man. And of course, Renaissance means rebirth. And, you know, we most often think of it was the rebirth of, you know, these beautiful ancient cultures and these ancient traditions and these ancient art styles. But to your point, Egypt was a very big part of that, even though we tend to stay focused on the Romans and the Greeks when it comes to the Florentine Renaissance. There was a very important undercurrent of Egyptian mysticism that we will talk about in a second. But I want to talk about the Medici family, because what happens is the very first Medici that is recorded is in the service of Charlemagne. So, you know, that's that's sort of an immediate eye-opener for those of us who have, you know, sort of studied these bloodlines and these traditions of heresy in Europe. Certainly anyone who is very close to Charlemagne, and the legend is that this Medici was Charlemagne's personal bodyguard. And then there is another legend that the Medicis were Charlemagne's personal physicians. And in fact, de Medici comes from this idea of being a healer, the medico, the medical person. So what we have is we have a family with a very, very interesting background in terms of who they were connected to and what kind of traditions they were connected to. What I discovered in this process is that they were very, very deeply embedded in what we discover becomes the Order of the Holy Sepulchre, which are these heretical traditions of Gnostic Christianity. Cosimo de' Medici is Lorenzo de' Medici's grandfather, and he is the one who really begins this process of wanting to change the world with their wealth. Cosimo's father had really turned the Medici bank into an extremely wealth profitable endeavor. And as a result of their banking efforts, the Medici, by the time Cosimo comes of age, are extraordinarily wealthy and powerful. Cosimo's brilliance comes into the effect and makes this even greater, multiplies the Medici wealth. But to your point, what he then does is he says, I am going to take this money and change the world with it. And he goes on this quest, which is all about preserving ancient traditions and ancient mysticism and protecting it and also spreading it to the world in ways in which he will not find himself at loggerheads with the church. And this is where the art comes in, because a lot of this is about embedding these traditions into symbolism to protect those elements of the teachings which are going to be potentially heretical to them. Now, they hide behind Plato a lot. And what you see most often with the Renaissance is, oh, everything here is Neoplatonic. The Renaissance is all based on these humanist traditions and these traditions that come from Plato. And while that is true, it is not solely true. And what I get at the Poet Prince is these concepts of humanism actually come from the Gnostic and heretical Christian traditions of becoming fully anthropos. Being fully anthropos means becoming a fully realized human. Therefore, this idea of humanism is as Gnostic as it is Platonic. And what we've lost in our analysis of the Renaissance is this beautiful, Gnostic, powerful Christian tradition that has to do with the divine feminine and with hieros gamos, with sacred union. And this is something that the Medici completely understood, completely celebrated, and really, really wanted to protect. And this is sort of the lost thread of the Renaissance that nobody talks about. But that becomes really, really critical to understand the work of Botticelli specifically within this process. And this is where Leonardo falls. Leonardo is not a part of that piece of the Renaissance. Now, he starts out that way. He starts out with Verrocchio. He starts out in the same studios. All these guys are sort of raised together in this sort of beautiful Medici art school, which is also a heresy school. But Leonardo never quite fits in. And I tell his story in The Poet Prince. And those who know me know that I'm not a Leonardo fan, but I think you'll find that I am sympathetic to him in the story. He's not a bad guy. I don't bash him. I simply tell a story of someone who is never able to entirely fit in with the rest of these humanist artists. And the way that I see it and the way that I present it in the book is this. These humanists, as they are trained by the Medici and as they are given spiritual instruction as well as artistic instruction, are taught, as you say, like the Egyptians, to use intent in their painting. They called it infusion technique. And infusion technique means when they are creating a work of art, they are infusing it with the energy of what they are trying to convey from the very beginning. So even from the time that the pigments are being crushed to create the paint, there is a certain intent that is going into it. You know, we want to convey this to the viewer of this piece of art. So everything happens with intention, which means it is a combination of heart, spirit, and mind. And this is what a Botticelli mastered above anyone else. Well, Michelangelo comes a little bit later, but he absolutely masters it as well. And we'll talk about him in a second. But Leonardo couldn't do this. And Leonardo couldn't do it because Leonardo is disconnected from the neck down. Leonardo is a cerebral genius. Everything he does is entirely mental. He comes from his brain. He does not come from his heart. He does not come from his spirit. It's entirely cerebral. And because he was not capable of connecting to this wholeness that the other Renaissance artists were able to do, he ultimately did not fit in. And as a result, there was, you know, a lot of bad blood there. And he is, you know, essentially expelled from Florence. You know, he's sort of kindly sent to Milan as a gift, you know, to the Sforza family. Here, have a great artist because we can't use him anymore. But he's not welcome in Florence for a lot of reasons, but specifically because he is not able to make that connection. And he was not willing either to embrace these teachings of divine feminine and sacred union. They didn't work for him, and he just couldn't deal with it. Whereas Botticelli and Michelangelo mastered them.
Exactly. And again, there are two aspects of Leonardo which I think underline that. As you mentioned, he only really produced 15 paintings in his entire life, and then with great difficulty. Everything he did was highly thought out, but always over-engineered. And it doesn't. When you're standing in front of a Botticelli, you fall in love with the people in there. Probably the only painting which, you know, comes close to a beautiful woman, which Leonardo has painted, is the Mona Lisa. And you kind of like stand there and you think like, okay, what are we supposed to be thinking of there?
The most overrated painting in the history of the world. Just saying.
Absolutely. And the other thing, of course, is as you were pointing out, that all of these people have to become fully anthropos. They have to become fully human. They have to be in touch with their bad sides and in touch with their good sides, and they have to accept the bad sides for what they are and largely transform them and use their entire human being for what they do. And it's a matter of record that Leonardo had tremendous problems in his sexual life, in various other aspects of his personal life, in trying to kind of get out of his cocoon. And pretty much for his entire life, he stayed within this cocoon, which is why he was late. He was stubborn. One of the most famous, the Last Supper, is a study in stubbornness, whereby he was going to do a fresco, and everybody is telling him, "What you're doing is not going to work." And he insists, and he says, "No, I know perfectly what I'm doing here because I am the great Leonardo," and pretty much, I've forgotten the time frame, but almost like within days of him having painted it, the fresco began to fall apart.
Right.
And it is this stubbornness of like, no, I am right, even though I don't know anything about this. I am so intellectual, I will not listen to anything, which typifies Leonardo, and which is kind of like, you know, the reason why there is a book called The Da Vinci Code, because it's all about this academic kind of like, oh, did he hide something? With Botticelli, you just stand in awe. And over the past year, that's actually something which we discovered, that the famous Botticelli room in Uffizi actually is so overpowering on people that some of them can't take that energy contained within that room.
No, that room is incredibly powerful, and it's a huge room. But there are large benches in the center of that room, and I know that they're there for you to sit and appreciate the art, but I think they're also there because there is so much power in that room that it really can be extremely overwhelming. And we have discovered that there have been cases of people sort of essentially, you know, having mini breakdowns in that room because they can't handle the energy. And, you know, that's not our opinion. I mean, that's actually been in the news. We investigated this last year. There was a kind of a famous case last year in the Louvre where a woman freaked out and threw her teacup at the Mona Lisa. Now, by the way, I want to throw more than my teacup at the Mona Lisa. But I understand that what they were explaining is that sometimes art affects people in a way that is extremely powerful. And that has certainly been true in the Uffizi. In fact, I think you've discovered when you were doing the investigation into that particular syndrome, Stendhal syndrome, I believe it's called. When you were doing the investigation into Stendhal syndrome, which is how art can affect people in an extreme way, you discovered that the largest number of cases of Stendhal syndrome were found in the Uffizi and specifically in the Botticelli room. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And whereby people just left, not just that room, but left Uffizi not knowing where they were, completely disorientated. There's a list somewhere of like the 10 most common places where this syndrome takes place, and you will find that, you know, none of them list Leonardo as such, but they are all the great painters. They are the Michelangelos, they're the Botticellis, I believe there's one Holbein there. They are really all the painters which we know painted with that infusion technique. So it's not just mere speculation or like people like Botticelli attempting to do this. We know as a fact that 500 years on, what they did is successful, and people still get perplexed by what they were able to do and instill within their art.
Well, one of the things that's interesting in the Botticelli room, which is, again, it's enormous, and pretty much with the exception of a few of his early paintings, the majority of the Botticellis are in this room, including Primavera, which is essentially a mural. It is huge. But what's interesting to me is there is another painter represented at the far end who is not Botticelli, and it's one of the Flemish painters. And, you know, forgive my bad Dutch and feel free to correct me. But the Portinari altarpiece, which is a piece that was created for the Portinari family who were living in Bruges and representing the Medici Bank at the time, they have an extraordinary mural there, their altarpiece, by Hugo van der Goes. Did I butcher it?
No,
you're
very good, actually.
Hugo van der Goes. And the Portinari altarpiece is so beautiful. But again, super powerful. I mean, whoever is putting this art together really knows their stuff. Yes, of course, it was painted basically during the same period, but there are a lot of paintings that were painted during the same period. And the fact that Van der Goes gets this sort of pride of placement with Botticelli, I've always found interesting. And for my Magdalen friends out there, the Portinari altarpiece contains the single most pregnant Mary Magdalene ever painted. We can put a link to it on the Spirit Revolution and show you what that painting looks like, because it's really extraordinary and incredibly beautiful. One of the things that I have done in the Uffizi that is interesting and also was part of my inspiration for this book is I have sat on that bench in the middle of the Botticelli Gallery and listened for an hour to 2 hours at a time to art experts and tour groups coming through. And I've listened to these experts and these tour guides for hours on end over the last couple of years give different explanations of what the Botticellis mean. And of course, nobody agrees. And certainly the one that nobody agrees upon, which is the focal point of my book, is Botticelli's magnificent Primavera, the allegory of spring. And I have sat there and listened to so many explanations of who that woman is in the center, from we have no idea to she represents Venus to, you know, there are so many different versions of what is actually going on in this painting. And this painting has mesmerized me for such a long time. And I think being myself being born at the vernal equinox and being such a spring girl, I've always been fascinated by this painting and how it represents spring. And so as a result, I felt a real personal connection to it. And I started to dig and I said, I really want to understand this painting, because it was one of those things, talk about infusion. When you stand in front of this painting, you feel all kinds of different, you know, emotions. And it's so large and there's so much going on that depending on where you stand looking at this painting, you get different feelings. So I just all these different explanations that I was reading, whether it was, you know, in art books, or even history books, just felt very pat to me. They just didn't feel like any of them were, you know, really helping me get to the magnificence and the glory and the love and the lushness that Botticelli was conveying in this painting. So that painting really became my muse for writing The Poet Prince. And the woman at the center, the focal piece of this painting, really became my muse. And I discovered through my work that that woman was Lorenzo de' Medici's great love, the woman he fell in love with when they were teenagers. They were never able to be together. Their love story is incredibly powerful and poignant and passionate and tragic. But she is the focal point of that painting, and she began to obsess me. I had to know who she was, and I had to know her story. And it is her story that I write for the most part in The Poet Prince in terms of the female side of the story, because she becomes not only Lorenzo's muse, but in many ways Botticelli's muse. Now, Botticelli had two muses, and we'll talk about his other muse, the more famous one, the magnificently beautiful blonde Simonetta. But these women really started to come alive for me. The more I sat in the Uffizi and listened to people talk about these women, the more I had to know who they were. Who was this beautiful Venus Simonetta? Who is this woman who I see over and over again Botticelli painting in the center of Primavera as a Madonna with a tilted head? Same face, same posturing. Who were these women that Botticelli was so inspired by that he made them the embodiment of feminine beauty and feminine power? And how did they impact the Renaissance? And as I dug, what I discovered is these women in their own way also really changed the world. And yet, aside from looking at how beautiful they are through the paintings, we've forgotten who they were. So part of The Poet Prince is really about celebrating this concept of muse in art.
And just tying into another aspect, which is like Renaissance is obviously rebirth, as you were pointing out. But you also found out that even though we now call this painting the Primavera, really, it's got another name.
Yes, it was not originally called Primavera. That is a name that apparently was tacked onto it about the 18th, 19th century, late 18th, early 19th century, from what I understand. And the big shock for me as I was digging into the history of Botticelli was discovering in several locations a particular reference which said, we believe the original title of this painting was The Time Returns. You know, it was one of those moments when I discovered that, you know, you jump up and down and you scream because you've just been handed, you know, a treasure chest full of priceless jewels. This idea that Botticelli and Lorenzo both wanted to call this painting The Time Returns teaches us so much more about what this painting really means, and where it was really going. It was such a huge insight and a huge clue into what is happening in their philosophy and their spirituality as they are putting together what is essentially their masterwork. You know, I mean, the bottom line is that Primavera is the masterpiece of what these people believed in one painting.
Exactly, and it's really how to summarize your doctrine was something probably everybody had to do at the Platonic Academy and say, like, you know, okay, you create something which just typifies what you have now learned, and the Primavera is so all encompassing. It shows off Botticelli's art, his mastery of art, and it also shows off in the details which you explain in the book how every single tiny bit of detail in that painting is significant. So unlike some other person, which we have stopped naming. But also the other aspect I think of Botticelli and what is going on here is the fact that we are once again embodying a very old tradition, which is that they, at a first level, the Renaissance seems to be all about Platonic love, this concept of love in a new way, which is somewhat similar to the courtly love as it was known in previous centuries. But there's really much more to it than that. There's really much more to this story, because whereas traditionally the Renaissance is seen as a liberation from Christianity, as Christianity is really oppressive, and the Medici's kind of go, okay, let's forget about Christianity, let's just do all of these things which the ancient Greeks did, and then we will be happier. Actually, what you discovered and what you outline in the book is that at the very core of the Renaissance is a very fundamental belief in Christianity, but one which isn't like Christianity as it was practiced in the 15th century across Europe.
Well, what I find at the core is that it's a fundamental belief in Christianity in its purest form, and its Cathar-y form. It's Cathar form, it's pure form, the way that the heretics and the Gnostics practiced it. The Book of Love, my second book, gives a very detailed account of how these traditions were kept alive in Italy. Whereas a lot of people understand the French traditions have received a lot of airplay. There have been a lot of books written about the French traditions and how, you know, Gnosticism, Catharism was stayed alive in France. There is very little written about Italy. And it was when I discovered the traditions in Italy were as powerful as the French traditions, but even harder to find because of their proximity to Rome. They had to be so much more careful. They had to be so much more crafty about protecting what their beliefs were, embedding them in symbolism, creating encoded manuscripts and encoded paintings, because their nearness, their geography, in terms of being so close to Rome, made it so much more difficult for the Italians. So in my second book, The Book of Love, I go into deep detail about how the traditions were preserved in Italy. And it really sort of sets up the poet prince to help you understand, you know, that the Medici weren't living in a vacuum. This was not an island. They didn't just create this. They were born of this powerful tradition that has always been in Italy, of the purest pieces of what Jesus and his followers were teaching, that have absolutely nothing to do with the dogma of Rome. They are completely separate from that which makes Rome dogmatic and focused on economics and politics. In fact, they're entirely focused on the true teachings of Anthropos, of what it means to become a fully realized human. And as a result, what I do within The Poet Prince is I reveal some of these traditions, the way that they were practiced, and they're so incredibly beautiful. And one of the things that I am most proud of in this book, and that I'm really hoping people will, you know, find, you know, at least interesting, if not inspiring, is I talk about the concept of Immaculate Conception and what it really, really meant to the early Christians. And that it had absolutely nothing to do with virginity, but it had to do with this Gnostic tradition that we also see mentioned in the Gospel of Philip, as well as in the Liber Rosso and these other sort of heretical texts. And that is the idea idea that sacred union happens when lovers unite in a place of trust and consciousness. And all children who are conceived in a place of trust and consciousness are, in fact, immaculate. I talk about it a little bit in the Book of Love, but in The Poet Prince, I actually show you how this works. Now, what happens in the Renaissance and in the late Middle Ages, I'm going to tell this piece, and I want you to talk about the connections in France, because you have worked on this in the French traditions. There is an angelic component that becomes incredibly important and really evolves into a place of prominence by the Middle Ages in these Gnostic/heretical traditions in Italy. The angelic component becomes critical. Thus, all the angels painted in Renaissance art. Okay, these are not sort of random cherubs. What was happening is there are processes and prayers of invoking angelic energy that these people were using, archangelic traditions. And this whole idea of the poet prince as a prophesied child, is actually conceived as such. So in other words, the Medici family set out to conceive a child who would specifically fulfill this prophecy. And that child is Lorenzo de' Medici. Lorenzo de' Medici is the poet prince. And the prophecy in part reads, "The Son of Man shall choose when the time returns for the poet prince. He will inspire the hearts and minds of the people so as to illuminate the path of service and show them the way. This is his legacy, this and to know a very great love." Well, what happens is the Medici know that the poet prince, who, by the way, is a Capricorn-born male with Mars in a water sign. This is how the prophecy breaks down. I'm simplifying it because it's kind of complex the way that the prophecy is actually written, and the full thing is in the book. But basically, if there are any Capricorn men out there with Mars and Pisces specifically, that was Lorenzo's configuration. And it was believed that men with this configuration born within certain bloodlines were destined to do extraordinary things and be extraordinary leaders in the world of becoming fully anthropos, becoming fully formed humans. This was a powerful spiritual as well as temporal leadership position, thus the poet and the prince. The poet representing sort of the spiritual artistic side of what this man will bring to the world in terms of grace, and the prince in terms of his ability to lead. So what happens is the Medici family, with the help of magi, exactly the same kind of magi as predict the birth of Christ, the same kind of magi exist in Italy in the 15th century. So with the help of the magi, they create a specific time to conceive this child. And Cosimo de' Medici's son, Piero, is determines to be the father. And then they go in search of the woman to become who essentially Mary. They want to find their Mary, the woman who's going to carry this promised golden messianic child. They find an incredible woman named Lucrezia Tornabuoni, who becomes the wife of Piero de' Medici, and she is chosen for her own sort of pristine bloodline connections in Italy. And she becomes essentially the new Mary. She becomes the woman who will carry the golden child. And so what happens is an elaborate process of conception occurs, and it's beautiful. It is this beautiful tradition of conceiving a child in an environment of absolute beauty. And so I recreate that in the book. I show you how the woman is gowned in white silk, and the bedclothes all have to be white, and everything is draped, and there has to be beautiful harp music, that white lilies represented the scent of heaven. So the room would be filled with lilies, and that basically all of the senses would be stimulated in the process of this man and woman coming together, literally and figuratively, to create the poet prince. And what happens in this process of very specific, intentional conception is at the time of union, the woman is chanting a prayer to invoke an angelic presence to come into her body. And thus the poet prince is conceived. And he is delivered, by the way, exactly on the date that the magi predicted. So Lorenzo becomes essentially the new Messiah. And that is what is incredibly magical and also incredibly lost to history, is that none of this was an accident. This was all extremely intentional, focused ritual and ceremony to bring him into this world to change it. And so he arrives with this burden on his shoulders that it is his responsibility to go forth and save these teachings, protect these teachings, and take them into a new world and a new golden age. And thus the time returns. The time returns every time there are golden children on this planet with a focused and sort of determined devotion to change the world. And I believe right now in the 21st century, we are reliving the time returns. And I believe that now more than ever, we have the ability to create this golden age that the Medici were trying to create, that Lorenzo was trying to create. I think the time returns and we're here to do all over again. And we can learn from everything they left us by studying what went so right in the Renaissance, but also what went so wrong.
Absolutely. And actually, before I delve into the French component, the way you were relating this angelic presence and the interaction between the afterworld and our realm and the creation of these divine children. There's an excellent book by Professor Archie Roy called The Eager Dead. And it is a massive book. It is the best doorstop ever. but it is also one of the best books written on the subject. In short, it details the cross correspondences. And for people who are interested in, like, you know, is there life after death? Well, the cross correspondences is the closest we have to scientifically accepted proof that there is life after death. This is an extraordinary and way too long story to go into here. But Archie Roy, The Eager Dead, goes into the cross correspondences. Archie, during his research into the cross correspondences, actually finds out something else, which is that these people who have died and who have decided that they want to tell the surviving members of their group that there is life after death, once they have accomplished this, they go on to something else. And what they try to do is to have one of the women involved in that group conceive. And on the other side, they are going to make sure that the soul which is actually entering the fetus, the babe, is going to be a very select soul. And so what we have is that actually the child is conceived, the child is born, and for most of its early life, this child was told that he was created in this very special ritual with help from the other side, and that he was there to change the world, that he was there to show certain people in the West certain things. Now, this didn't happen 500 years ago. This happened in the 20th century. And the boy who was created is dead now, but pretty much he, throughout his life, was just unable to live up kind of, you know, the challenge which his family had given to him. And just the knowledge that he was going to have to do this from a very early age on was just too much for him. He literally became a hermit monk, and actually, I think, took a vow of silence at some point in his life. So he completely withdrew. But doing the French component in some brevity is the fact that, yes, in France, after the Renaissance, which is obviously Italian primarily at the end of the 15th century, the Renaissance and all of that movement travels across the Alps into France. And one of the first areas where it settles is in Lyon. And Lyon is the second biggest city in France. It still is. And it's actually nicknamed the esoteric capital of France because most of the esoteric alternative groups have their roots in Lyon. Martinism, Papou, all of these people come from Lyon. And in the 16th century, we find a group which we now know as the Angelic Society, who begin to do a translation of a book which is called Hypnoteramachia Polyphili, which we will definitely go into at some point in the future. But let's just say that it is some form of codification of what the Renaissance in Italy is all about, and it's sealed into one extremely hard-to-read book and transported into France. And in France, again, you have this society, which is now known as the Angelic Society, who begins to study this. And then from there on, we see the move to Paris. And now, interestingly enough, when we reach the 19th century, oh, of all possible places, where do we find the headquarters of the Angelic Society to be? Saint-Sulpice, the very same place which is so loved by the people of Rennes-le-Château, which has inspired, you know, so many aspects of that guy's code. And it's specifically one specific chapel in there. It's got nothing to do with gnomons or anything like that. It's the Chapel of the Angels, which was deemed to be the headquarters of these angelic society members. And they were very clear that they were not part of, like, you know, due-paying members of a society. They felt that to become members of the angelic society, so the very thing these people had to do was have a very special bond with angels. And their specific bond was that they were actually going to challenge the angels. They had a very interactive relationship with angels. And when you start looking at the people in history who are supposed to have been members of this organization, we have Nicolas Poussin, we have Jean Cocteau, we have George Sand, we have got various other people. Anatole France, for example, is another very important member. All of these people are always tangentially involved or directly involved with the so-called mystery of the Priory of Zion or the mystery of Rennes-le-Château. And really, everything which the Priory of Zion is in popular mythology is really ill-understood aspects of the core phenomenon, which is the Renaissance and this basic belief and practice of becoming fully anthropos. That's a very long explanation there.
No, it's a very good explanation, and I think it also brings up a sort of a touchy subject, which will cause people on the internet to start screaming about how much they hate me. But you know, this is the problem with the whole Priory of Sion thing, is that it really doesn't exist and it really doesn't matter, other than that it became kind of a catch-all for a lot of these mysteries that people didn't understand otherwise. So, you know, this whole concept of what the Priory of Sion is was whatever. It was created, it was manufactured. But the fact is, the underlying piece of it is it was manufactured, you know, for multiple purposes. But the bottom line is there were real societies, there were real events, there were real practices, real teachings, and real secrets that were going on, much of them to do with the Renaissance and what was coming out of the Renaissance, much of them that was coming out of these sort of Gnostic and heretical traditions, you know, in different levels. There are all kinds of different sort of, it's kind of like, it's tricky, because what happened when all of this sort of exploded with Holy Blood, Holy Grail, is everything became lumped into this category of, well, it's the Priory of Sion or it's the Knights Templar. And it's really, in most cases, none of those things. It's a very powerful tradition of Gnosticism and mysticism that comes in a lot of different forms. There are a lot of factions, as you know. There are a lot of different versions of it. You know, it's not just one organization. There's a lot of different people practicing this in different ways. And unfortunately, most of them were not terribly organized, which is why there's not a lot of it left, because it was so marginalized and then factionalized. And some of the factions happen simply for preservation. You know, when you're practicing heretics in a time and place where being a practicing heretic is going to get you and your people massacred, you sort of by definition have to become very secretive about what you do. And you also have to be incredibly careful about who you trust. And that's where the factions began to happen. So my frustration with this topic in France becomes the sort of general populace's need to say, oh, it's Prior of Sion, or oh, it's Knights Templar, when it's really none of those things.
Absolutely, and it isn't all about this. Again, it's not about the secret society as such, and the power the secret society is supposed to have. Really, what you are illustrating in The Poet Prince and in all of your works is that the real power is about the knowledge and specifically the wisdom which true understanding gives, and this fully humanized potential, which is really such a transformative effect. We'll come back to it probably next week. But the influence of Lorenzo on the population of Florence is just phenomenal. He just wasn't, you know, when we are looking at the world leaders today, we are very fortunate to have, for example, a person like Obama, who is a man who is deemed to be infused with leadership. But when you compare an Obama today to what apparently Lorenzo was able to do in Florence, Obama is really a very frail person compared to the inspiration Lorenzo could give to his people.
Lorenzo was, in my opinion, the most remarkable leader in the history of Europe, and the most underrated. And, you know, as we you know, sort of prepare to wrap this week. I think that we're looking into doing another, you know, continuing this into next week because there's so much to talk about here. What I want to say about Lorenzo is this. You know, as I write for the last 20 years, I've been writing about women who have been maligned and misunderstood and who have been unfairly portrayed in history. But it wasn't until discovering Lorenzo de' Medici that I realized just how tragic this kind of mislabeling of historical character can be. Now, the funny thing is, when I say Medici to Americans, for the most part, they all go, oh, they were bad guys, you know, the first crime family. And a lot of times they sort of confuse the Medici and the Borgia, too, by the way. Borgias
are all Italian.
Yeah, they're all Italian and powerful and had something to do with the church. But we'll come back to the Borgias. They're going to get their own show because there's a lot to talk about there. But focusing on the Medici, when I started digging, I discovered these stories. And again, how they were twisted. For example, this is one of my favorite examples of how the Medici legacy was completely distorted. Cosimo de' Medici is the first character to really set up art academies where he is not only training and paying his artists, but he is protecting them. He essentially, he is backing these guilds that are making sure that the artists are being taken care of, that they are being treated fairly, that they are not being ripped off, that they are being paid for their work, and that they are being highly respected in the community. Cosimo de' Medici is the first person to step in and say, art will save the world. Art will save the world, and we, as a result, need to protect our artists. Now, one of the things that's important to remember here is how many unbelievable, extraordinarily talented artists lived at the time of the Renaissance. This is not an accident, and that's part of the point of my book. These people didn't just happen to show up in this time and space. This is part of the time returns concept. The Medici believed, as did the other practicing members of the order throughout Europe, that they were in a special time, they were in a golden age, and special children were being born who were of angelic talents. And they referred to them as the angelics. And this is one of the things that Cosimo did. Cosimo went in search of the angelic talent in Europe and then took care of it, protected it, patronized it, allowed it to flourish. And this is why you have incredible artists like Donatello showing up under Cosimo. Filippo Lippi, one of the greatest of the Renaissance artists. Both Donatello and Lippi worshipped Cosimo de' Medici. When Cosimo de' Medici died, Donatello was distraught. He threw himself in front of Cosimo's coffin and begged to be buried at his feet. And in fact, he died within 2 years of Cosimo, and people say he died of a broken heart because he could not live without his patron who had been so kind to him and had encouraged him and given him so much inspiration as an artist. And incidentally, Donatello is buried, not at his feet, but beside Cosimo, in the Basilica of San Lorenzo in Florence, which I think is incredibly beautiful. Same thing with Lippi. Cosimo protected Lippi. Lippi is one of the great characters in art history. He was Fra Filippo Lippi because he was sort of forced to take vows and go into an order and become a monk. His passion for women was a little bit too strong for him to keep those vows. And ultimately, he falls in love with a young girl when he is painting in Prato. And she becomes the mother of his child, and Cosimo protects him from the church and ensures that they're able to get married and takes care of them. And the story of Filippo Lippi and Cosimo de' Medici is such a beautiful and fun, amazing celebration of friendship and mutual respect. And yet, as I investigated it, I would find the really harsh versions of it in art history books, things that would say Cosimo de' Medici was such a tyrant, he would lock his artists up in the basement and not feed them until they produced works of art. And so, you know, none of that felt, when I first read those ideas, none of that felt right to me. I'm like, if Cosimo was abusing his artists, if he was starving them and locking them up, and he was truly this much of a monster, why were they begging to be buried at his feet? Why were they so distraught at his loss that they couldn't function or paint for years afterwards? It didn't work for me. And as I began to dig, what I discovered is there's a wonderful story about Cosimo de' Medici locking up Filippo Lippi in an apple basement and making him paint, only because the church is going to arrest him if he doesn't finish his commission. So Cosimo creates a place for him where he has to go and paint, and he feeds him and he takes care of him and he provides him what he needs and forces him to finish the painting so the church doesn't throw him in jail. And it's this very sort of comical, wonderful story. And I tell that story in The Poet Prince. But you see, what happens is then it gets twisted in history as Cosimo was a tyrant. Cosimo was evil. Cosimo shackled his artists and, you know, beat them and starved them. None of which was true. So this is the beginning of the demonization of the Medici. And all roads literally lead to Rome in these stories, in that the demonization of the Medici comes from the fact that they opposed the Pope, they opposed traditional Catholicism, and that got them in trouble.
And they were definitely one of the true spirit revolutionaries as a family, which have ever been there. So we will come back to Kathleen's launch of The Poet Prince next week, but for now, we leave you with the old-time favorite quote from, well, The Poet Prince as well. Until next week, from Kathleen and I,
the truth against the world.
And art will save it as well.